If you're enjoying our podcast and have a recommendation about someone you think we should have on to share their voice and journey with the world, by all means, let us know. It could be an aid worker, monastic, author, journalist, doctor, resistance leader, really anyone with some tie or another to the ongoing situation in Myanmar or anything related to its history or culture. To offer up a name, go to our website, insightmyanmar.org, and let us know. But for now, just sit back and take a listen to today's episode.
Bendjirat Chua, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, so you have, as a Thai citizen, you have been involved in the neighboring country of Myanmar for some time as an academic, as an activist, as a friend of many Myanmar people. And mm-hmm. we're set to explore some of that journey as to how far your academic and professional career stretches back across the 2,400-kilometer border between Thailand and Myanmar, mm-hmm. And how that's continued today post-coup. And so I'd like to begin by asking you, where did it all begin for you? How did Myanmar first come on your radar, and how did you first become involved?
It started in 1999 mm-hmm. when I started to work in a small NGO called Friends Without Border, which was a new project back then set up to raise awareness among the Thai people about the displaced people from Myanmar. So I worked there for 2 years. It was during that time that I get to know about the situation in Myanmar. I went to a number of refugee camps, talked to migrant communities, ethnic groups. But of course, the situation back then was different from what, in a way similar, but in another way, it's different from what's going on now. So that was in 1999 to 2001. And then later when I joined the Institute of Human Rights and Peace Study at Mahidol University, a number of our students were displaced Burmese, so activists mostly, especially like the 88 generation who came to live in Thailand. But I got more involved working with students from Myanmar or academic in Myanmar in 2018 or 2019, when we worked with our partner in Myanmar to do training and research mentorship for university lecturers from Faculty of Law, because the civilian government issued a policy to have international human rights law as compulsory course in the law faculty across the country. So my colleague and I from Mahidol University, we did like training on how to teach human rights. We do research mentorship for lecturers in Myanmar. But of course, that was disrupted by the coup. And after the coup, we, again, together with partner in Myanmar and also abroad, organized a project to give scholarship for to students, now the student in Myanmar to come to study at our program, at human rights program in Thailand. And also we do develop a human rights online course, which we hope that one day could be part of the MA in human rights in Burma. So we develop curriculum, we work with tutors, we did online training, And also partly we continue with the research mentorship where we work with mostly CDM lecturers and youth activists, train them on how to do research on human rights and peace and democracy, and work with them until they can publish their research.
That's incredible. That's all very interesting. And you mentioned that it all began in 1999, a different yet similar situation. Yeah. And Myanmar goes in anything. If anything, we could say Myanmar goes in cycles. And it can be very helpful to understand where we are now by understanding the past. And and that came through an activist, people-to-people organization, Friends Without Borders. And this was really one of the very first kind of organizations of its time, of its place, a Thai organization that was focused on the problems and situation in Myanmar and going to help and engage them. And so I wonder if you can go back to that time and just talk about, what was the similar yet different situation that you found, and what was your intention at that time as to what you wanted Friends Without Borders to do?
I think at that time, Friends Without Borders tried to, as I mentioned, we tried to raise awareness among the Thai public because the attitude of the Thai public against the people from Myanmar was terrible. We
were
taught, I guess you are already aware of what we were taught in the school. The antagonistic feeling between the two communities are terrible. But given with the situation in Myanmar and the influx of the refugee and displaced people in Thailand, we thought that it would be great if the Thai people understand what's going on in Myanmar, what was going on in Myanmar, and understand why people are here and are willing to support them to ensure their rights. So I think that still continues even until today, although I think it may be a little bit better and people know more about, if we look at the situation these days, that kind of prejudice against Burmese maybe still be there, but I think people are more exposed to what happened in Myanmar. At least they learned about the military coup or if you look back in 2021, when there was a youth movement in Thailand, youth movement, and then there was a coup in Myanmar. I think Thai people understand, have that shared feeling or understanding of the situation. So I would say it's a little bit better, but it is not good enough to make a concrete policy change that would benefit the displaced people. I think that's something that we still need to work a lot to make sure that the Thai public also support any policy to guarantee the rights of the displaced Burmese, and even better, to have more proactive policy on the Thai government side to address the situation in Myanmar. What else? The similarities, of course, is where we see activism in displaced activists or exile activists operating and in Thailand, but with more intensity, I would think. Now, if we go to Method or Chiang Mai, we saw the Burmese activists everywhere, more and more people come. And it's no longer only like the political activists or student activists, but I saw kind of awareness among the youth in Myanmar. And probably because of the military conscription, more and more people are engaged in different kinds of activism. So more activism among the displaced Burmese in Thailand, I think, when compared to back then in 1999.
Right. So, you're talking about the difference between the Thai-Myanmar engagement, especially Thai perceptions of Burmese, and you're also referring to the growth in student activism and activism that we see happening now, which I think is definitely the case. Yeah. How about if you're looking at it through the perspective of Myanmar itself, when you started to the situation in Myanmar, what Myanmar people were going through, when you first started to get engaged in 99, what issues were you seeing? And more than a quarter century later, more than 25 years after that, how do you see those situations improving, worsening, or how are they different if you contrast them?
Oh, Maybe I can look at before the political transition and during the political transition and then after the coup. I had to say, I went into Myanmar, like proper Myanmar, Yangon, and other parts of Myanmar only in 2018 or 19. But before that, I only visited along the border. Okay, that's the context of how I look at the situation. I think back, like when I was working in 99, when I talked to people from Myanmar back then, I had to admit I could not see prospect of change. But then change happened, right? Although not as perfect as we may expect. And then there's a lot going on during the political transition. I would not imagine that we could teach how to teach human rights in Myanmar.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. And that like the whole country, I think I went to almost like 10 universities across the country, although it was new to people. People not even the university lecturer, they were still struggling on how to teach human rights. Most of them would just read the text, translate the text in Burmese. But then that completely changed. Now those lecturers that I worked with before the coup, they are now so confident. They are now well-versed in human rights discourse. They know about human rights principle. They can teach human rights on their own. So I think this awareness of rights, which may be only limited among political activists, expand to the people, and now it's everywhere. The youth that we may not see their role much during the political transition, now we see that they have political awareness. And another thing is, I think what happened with how the activists or even human rights community in Myanmar deal with the Rohingya really show this change in political awareness. I was always upset when I talk to Burmese activists or human rights or those pro-democracy back then they don't acknowledge what happened to the Rohingya. They even deny that happened. Or those people I talk to, they call the situation in Rakhine State, not even saying that Rohingya that face atrocity. But now everyone acknowledge what happened. I think this is very significant. What happened during the political transition where people get to know more news and ideas, where democracy and human rights discourse got into the country and people learn about that, which we see with the CDM and the protests against the military coup. I think that's really significant.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so then as you're charting your early involvement, I mean, we've looked at it through a number of different prisms, and another perspective that we can look through is that of formal Thai-Myanmar relations. Those have certainly changed over the years, over the recent years, and then decades before that, even before 88, it was a very different situation. And I know you've been engaged with this as a Thai citizen, as an activist, as a professor, but also as an academic and someone who studied history and the way this has changed. So if you could walk us through your understanding of those more formal state-to-state relations.
Oh, I may not like didn't really follow that closely. I think still Thailand still do not like they do that the ASEAN way where they don't interfere into Myanmar internal and domestic national politics, and so they still keep that relationship, or even until now as we see that they don't get involved and do not try to make any change in Myanmar. And I think we cannot just say about the state and state relationship without looking at the role of business actors in both Thailand and Myanmar, the Thai investor that will invest in Myanmar and benefit from that situation and even continue to benefit in this conflict situation. So in that sense, not much has been changed in terms of if we expect Thailand to play more role in this. But as Thailand has to bear the consequences of the conflict in Myanmar. I think we see some positive change inside the country with, for example, registration of undocumented migrant workers, which, again, it's not a perfect system, but it helped getting people, undocumented migrant workers, to have some documentation, to get their rights protected. That changed a lot. And just a small note when I talk about this, and that reminds me of like 20 years ago when I worked with people from Myanmar or migrant workers in the city, for example. They were afraid, they didn't show that they are from Burma or they can be arrested anytime. I even saw some authorities check people's ID at the Victory Monument, a big crowded area. But maybe almost about 10 years ago, I saw Burmese wearing in Burmese costume in the street of Bangkok with Tanaka and everything. And I was very overwhelmed when I saw that, because it shows that they don't have to be in fear. At least they don't have to live in fear in Thailand, because they may have some kind of document. So in that sense, I think it may not be like state and state relationship that leads to change inside Myanmar, but the way that we recognize people from Myanmar in Thailand, I think that's better.
You've talked about the conditioning role that that Thai education system has had on relations. This was also something that our mutual friend Nick Chawawat mentioned in his interview, particularly the shadows of Ayutthaya and how that's played out in Thai popular culture as kind of demonizing the Burmese as this the scary conquering hero from literally many centuries past. Yeah. And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about those who are outside Thailand, who didn't go through Thai public education, as to if you can unpack that comment a little more and talk about in what ways you feel that there has been some conditioning or propagandizing that has oriented at least some generation of Thais to look to their neighbors with a bit of fear or anxiety. Mm.
That's the historical narrative of Thai political history, Thai national history, with the Ayutthaya, the former capital of Thailand before Bangkok, which was, more than 300 years old. And Ayutthaya, we were told, and there was a conflict with the Burmese king. And the history says that Ayutthaya was burned down by the Burmese army. And we still see the old palace in Ayutthaya even until today. So the Thai education system keep telling about this narrative of history. Our rich, beautiful capital were burnt down. Our gold was stolen by the Burmese. Our king was kidnapped and spent some time. So that, what's interesting is it's not only in the school textbook. This kind of story, narrative, or propaganda to a certain extent has been retold many times, including in the movie, King Narasimhan, and so many movies, not just only that. And a number of these movies were hugely funded by the government. Thai students, school students were brought to watch this movie. So it's not just about education, it's the whole narrative is in the country. Movie, textbooks, we see that in the TV series and drama when they portray people from Myanmar. But having said that, I think we also need to note that Thai people place themselves in kind of superior position when they compare to their neighboring countries. This does not only happen to Burmese, but also to Laos, to Cambodia. But we had law. We, we had war with Myanmar, that made things worse.
It's interesting. You talk about how this was over three centuries ago. Hmm. My country is not three centuries old. You know, so we had a war with England in, you know, obviously in 1776 and then again in 1812. We've gotten over it. And 300 years is a long time. And so to continue to flesh out those kind of ghosts of the past, it is a very long time removed.
Ah, yeah, but it, okay. Thank you, because I think that made me realize that I missed the important part. It is not always there, right? But we need to look at the Thai, like, modern education system, which is relatively new. We don't have that long history of the education system. I'm not sure if this kind of political narrative were there in the previous, in the old education system. But Thailand education and bureaucracy was modernized maybe less than 200 years ago. And then this, during the about 50s, 60s, that the political leaders also try to build the nationalism and nationalist discourse. So, yeah, it is part of the political project of the Thai political leaders also. It's not just that, oh, we always hate the Burmese.
Sure, and I mean, you see that in certainly in more countries than Thailand. You see after World War II, you know, Germany went through really some reconciliation and some deep reflection on a national level as to what happened in the Holocaust, but it was a different story in the East. And you see still today, Korea and much more so China, you know, how China is able to whip things into a certain kind of fervor by pointing at, you know, Japanese atrocities. It's a story that will never get old. We see the same with, you know, Israel in the Middle East and some of the Muslim and Arab countries that can keep pointing to Zionist fears as a way to not have to look internally at their own human rights issues or democracy or you know, what they're doing to their own citizens. And so it certainly is not an isolated incident to look at. But, you know, then the question is, what are we seeing in the modern generation? Are we seeing that same education being perpetuated? And if it is, to whatever extent, what degree are we seeing the Thai youth being able to reject those narratives, which I've seen quite a lot of examples of, and be able to, you know, Milk Tea Alliance is a wonderful example of that, and be able to transcend religion and ethnicity, nationality, skin color, and be able to make connections through activism, through art, through, you know, many other means.
Yeah, you have said it all, actually. I think, again, I like to bring it back to the Thai youth movement in 2020 that show what you just described. And although I, like, my research interest is on the movement and pro-democracy movement, so I also follow some of the youth, Thai youth activists, especially after the 2014 coup. Right? Yeah, that was the last time we had a coup. And even then, what happened in 2020 really struck me, surprised me. I didn't imagine that the current generation of the youth has that political awareness before, and that level of political awareness before. Probably because we were under military rule since 2014, people didn't have a chance to express much publicly about their political opinion. But then what they said, what they talk about during the 2020 to 2022 youth protests really show that they are not that nationalist, they are not that influenced, but under the influence of political narratives, the state political narratives, they understand human rights, they question principle of equality, and human rights and so on, and a multi-alliance show that they look beyond the national border, and for them, it's about human rights and democracy. But how big is that population?
Exactly.
That's, I'm not so sure. It was so it was so very impressive. It looked grand at a grand scale back then, but we also have come back and live in the realities, and there are also people maybe much bigger group of people who are still still live with this nationalist discourse.
Yeah, certainly. That has always been a question for me as to what there are prominent, incredibly courageous voices on the Thai side that that we hear from, but to what degree is that permeating across? And I think also from the number of interviews I've conducted, I've come to understand that there's a very different picture based on where you live in Thailand. And if you're living in the north, if you're living especially in along the border, versus if you're where you learn to live with it, and you learn it's a reality that is not hard to navigate, but then those fears get really stoked when you come to Bangkok or other places where small things get magnified or retold in different ways. But it also does make me wonder, you know, to what extent, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, to what extent is the work of those prominent Thai voices and artists and human rights defenders and others, to what extent are those strong voices being permeated in small ways to have small shifts in consciousness to the wider youth generation?
I think there are a number of innovative activities and also some of the youth-led or activist-led activities that try to work on this kind of education or awareness raising among the youth or among new generation of people. And I think that it's quite successful, and it can talk to quite a broad group of people. And even this day, when we may not see political action on the street as we used to see, sometimes I feel disappointed when something happened and we expect people to come out and say something against that. But at the same time, I know that there are small, small activities out there that try to keep this momentum. Mm. Again, how powerful it is, we don't know. But having said that, we need to recognize inequality within Thailand, the gap between the urban population and rural areas, where they may not have access to this kind of discussion that's still out there. So Bangkok youth, they may be more like exposed to this kind of discussion. Bangkok, Chiang Mai, but not everywhere. I still feel that, but use the term that we used to call the youth movement, that they have brought us to the point of no return. There are certain things that, okay, for example, the discussion about the monarchy, that completely changed the landscape, or how people talk about it has been changed completely. And it might be small thing. The way we talk about the monarchy these days are totally different from 5 years ago. And yeah, we will never return to back then, hopefully.
Right. And, you know, I've spoken to many Thai activists and people in Milk Tea Alliance from the Thai side on this platform. Mm. And one of the things that's come out in those conversations is that as terrible as the situation in Myanmar is, and as much as Thai allies have been active in trying to support their Burmese friends, it's not a one-way street. It's very reciprocal. And it's not that they're just there in a position of privilege and advantage and they're just giving to people who don't have it. The level of inspiration and knowledge sharing and that they're being exposed to, you know, how the ways that Thais on this platform have spoke so glowingly and so, you know, almost with reverence of like what their Burmese peers are doing in situations they couldn't begin to understand, it's reverberating back on how they're looking at their place and their system and what they could and maybe should be doing. Yeah. So I'm wondering from your standpoint, how have you seen, looking back the other way, because we've been talking a lot Thai towards Myanmar, looking back Myanmar towards Thailand, in what ways have you seen where activists have been involved, Thai activists have been involved in the Myanmar situation, that has brought new ideas and had them rethinking what they could do in the Thai system?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the CDM movement very, I think, very strike people and make us realize how courage people are and how can we work on like large scale movement.
Really?
Again, which we in Thailand we don't have that. So mm-hmm. I think that's something that very inspired us here in Thailand, and that's what we learn. Also, but I'm not sure how much we learn about like how to keep the momentum of the activism, especially now it's been 4 years and we continue. That's also the question that I also have, like how can we, what's going to happen with people who resist the authoritarian regime and they live in such a much difficult life, hoping that will be changed very soon, but now it has been so long. So I think, yeah, that's something that has really inspired the Thai activists. And we keep asking how can we mobilize that many people, right, to get people to join the democracy movement. And I have the level of discussion and exchange among the two groups, but not only two, of course, in Indonesia and Taiwan and Hong Kong, where we learn from each other.
Yeah.
It's very great learning for the Thai activists.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting because non-democratic actors like to try to manipulate and control their population by stoking fears of the other. And what transnational activism can do is to break down those false narratives and be able to see how much they have in common. Again, whether it's the Japanese or the Jews or whoever else that or the Burmese, whatever else those kind of age old fears are of being able to stoke those for that control. Because I'm also remembering one time when I was living in Yangon, I went to Sredagon Pagoda with a Thai friend. And, of course, Sredagon is famous for many reasons, but for one, just the sheer amount of gold that's in the main spear and in the pagoda. And she laughed and said, I bet that every Thai person, like, I'll tell you this, and I bet that every Thai person who comes here says the same thing. That's all Thai gold that came from Ayutthaya. And I laughed. And so, but where I'm leading towards this is connecting that with the previous comment about, authoritarian structures trying to stoke those fears. One of those fears being, this is all our gold that they put in their monument. You're talking about a sea change of a kind of shift that has occurred the last 5 years that have people thinking differently about not just Thai Myanmar relations, but many aspects of domestic internal Thai ways of thinking. Mm. And so can you flesh out any reason for where and how that shift would have come about?
I think the political conflict in the last almost two decades in Thailand, more than one decade in Thailand, really shifts many things. How people understand politics, how people discuss about this democracy and different issues. The debate was so intense in starting in 2005, right? Yeah, 20 years. And I think that's part of the experience under the NCPO, the National Council for Peace and Order, the military body, the junta, the coup body that was staged the coup in 2014. I would say the repression by the NCPO was very severe was the worst when we look at the Thai democratization period since, if we start from the 80s, what happened after 2014 coup was the worst in the last number of decades, the recent decades. And I think that made many Thai also realize the situation. And that brought into discussion a lot about democracy, about human rights. Even those who may support or demand for the military intervention before, the conservative force who engage in the anti-electoral politics in the in the mid-2010, they even changed their perception because they realized what came going on. And that coincided with the Rights of the People movement, people who protest against, people who come out, speak courageously against the elites or the establishment. I think the level of repression, the level of people awareness make all this shift in the political situation.
So then shifting to some of your other work in Myanmar, another area that you've been very involved in, like I'd like to prompt you on, is the right to education, access to education, especially at a time of conflict. And Myanmar has had so many years of conflict. Yeah. Education has to occur in some form, even as conflict is going on. So if you could tell us a bit about your work in that area.
Okay. If we focus on our work after the coup, as you know, the education system was interrupted partly because teachers, students, they joined the CDM movement, they left the school, and partly because of the armed conflict. So as a result, education system cannot continue in the way there was. So we work on providing not just any education, but human rights education. So we are one of the many education providers these days that provide online course, but we focus on human rights, and peace, and democracy. So we engage the CDM lecturers who now lost their job, but they still want to continue working on education. So we developed the curriculum, and some of the CDMer to take part as a tutor, and the courses delivered online. So we offer that for like third or fourth batch already, and each batch we have more than 200 students. Who took the not only one course, but to the whole package. Right? We have course on human rights, we have course on peace, course on environment and human rights, and need our human rights and technology. So they took part in that course. So that is one way that would allow students in Myanmar who do not want to join the junta's education system to continue to receive education, no matter where they are.
I think one of the remarkable things about that is we often think of education as insofar as it's relevant and applicable to one's situation. And when one is in Myanmar studying international human rights law, it's hard to imagine a situation where these concepts become more vital and more urgent given the background of who you are and the country that you're in. And so I'd be really interested to learn, as you work with Burmese professors and students going through what they've been through, not just now, but over their past history, just what you find of their receptivity and interest in how they're taking these concepts.
Oh, interesting. I think one of the questions that we receive all the time is, but this is not what's happening. Right, we learn about human rights principle, but what's going on the ground? That's not what's happening. How can we take the junta accountable? Our student, we also teach human rights. Welcome student who come to study in Mahidol, right? Sometimes our students are so upset when we talk about death penalty, and because that death penalty is anti-human rights, but then they wish that the military, Burmese military leader could be says death penalty for the crime they committed to the people. So I think that one thing is they look at human rights and they learn about human rights, and that make them upset when they realize that there's a huge gap between what should be and the reality they are facing in their everyday life.
Yeah.
But having said that, that happened to not only to Burmese. Every time we teach about human rights, people can't help comparing to what's happening on the ground. But I think we have to look at it in a long way. We cannot just look at it as the education that would respond to what they are facing currently. But if we look at it as the education that help the student or the learners learn about the principle, help them to be able to reflect on the situation and see what they can do to engage and to move towards those principle and ideology or that they can see. In the long run, I hope that it could benefit. Another thing is with the issue with the official education currently in Myanmar, I think we have to invest more on this parallel education system in different forms, because we cannot rely on the SAC. What's the name of the SAC? The UNTAS official education. And these parallel education and different pathways, education pathway, will really have implication in the long run.
I think what's amazing about the first part of your answer is you're describing the instruction of a formal protocol for international human rights law as their authoritarian military leadership is shredding any norms and killing people daily, and the international community is doing nothing about it. And, you know, it reminds me of, there's a famous cartoon that came about this where, you know, the UN had consistently been issuing these thoughts and prayers and grave concerns towards Myanmar. And the cartoon showed a Myanmar person consoling the United Nations for being so concerned all the time, just to show that, you know, they don't expect anything else, but they're compassionate that, you know, their concern is weighing them down. And I think, and I'm also reminded of a recent live podcast we did with Patrick Ponsathorn at Fortify Rights, where he referenced how when he got into the field as a human rights defender in the 1990s, it was a time of great optimism and what the international systems can do. Yeah. I don't know if in any of our lifetimes we've been at a lower point more distressing than we are now. Mm. And, you know, I think that that Myanmar is a case in point to that, if anything in the world is, that, you know, I've spoken to, you know, so many people, MPs and elected officials in so many countries across Asia and Europe since the coup happened. And there has been such outrage that their own countries and the international systems did not do what was right the minute that it should have been done.
Yeah.
And that, and when those lines haven't been drawn, the military has just seen more and more the kind of impunity they can act with. And so Patrick Ponsathorn was referencing this as, you know, how do we take this vocation into 2026 and the world that we're in today, with having these same aspirations, but the international system not working the way that we think it's supposed to, that it used to work, and that we learn about. And so I imagine, going back to your example, there must be extraordinary disconnect when you're teaching academically about how certain systems are working or should be working, but they're in a situation where they're getting bombed every day, no one's doing anything. And I wonder if at some point you've had students ask, what is the point of all this? Why are we learning this if nothing is working?
All the time. And not only from a Burmese student. In some years, I teach international human rights standard, but I also keep telling students I don't believe in the system. I mean, not that it's not useful at all. It has some of its benefit, right? It works sometimes, and not in the way that we may expect them to work with all the resources they have and everything. But I think teaching or learning about and another thing is, when we look at human rights, at our institute, or the way we teach human rights, it's not only about international human rights law or mechanism, but it is also about this thing that we have been discussing on the social political values, the underlying values, the belief system, the democracy, and state and citizen relationship, and that kind of aspect of human rights. Which, putting all this together, I think it helped the student to understand that the work of for human rights is not limited to the use of the UN and international government and that mechanism. And even when we look at those mechanisms, we should look at it as I also keep telling our students that it is not just about the law that we have, ICCPR, ICSCR, but it's about interpreting it, expanding it, its their meaning to the reality and use that to communicate to the people. Yeah, it's always upset if we look at the UN or international system as the answer. But I believe in the power of the people. I believe in the change political discourse, and that's where we should work. Just use some of those expansion of meaning of human rights for the benefit of the change in the culture of human rights.
And so then as you're teaching these concepts to a Burmese population that's under siege, I'm also curious, these aren't normal students, these aren't normal educational contexts or situations. The concepts that you're teaching, what about those subject matters are they most interested in?
Democracy in general. And I think the role of in this international system and how can they use. I was just reflecting on this, that the first batch of first 2 years of student after the coup, most of the research that the student want to work on are about the CDM. I think that's also new thing for them, and that's something they want to learn more, and they look at how the CDM can change the system. But now that kind of interest kind of die out, and they look at more broader issues of democracy and human rights. Yeah, so I think the students are interested in general, partly still on how to make use of this mechanism, and then how to understand different factors and the impact of human rights in Myanmar. For example, and more interest on armed conflict, the role of China, business and human rights, especially those come from Kachin state, because that really relate to their experience on international relations.
Mm-hmm. Right. And another aspect of that we see happening in Myanmar that is affecting Thailand directly is the prevalence of the scam centers.
Well, actually, just this morning, I saw a video clip of the bomb, one of the bomb, and some of the Thai people got injured from the, how you call it, the chapel of the bomb. I think we see more and more. Okay. One thing is more concern on Thai people or any people who travel in that area, right? That they could be a victim of the scammer. Big billboard in Mesot, they keep telling people that, okay, don't fall victim to the scammer, right?
Yeah.
And those who fled away from the scamming center and then got in between and cannot enter Thailand or got deported, I think that's the real impact that Thai authority will also need to work more.
Right. And then, of course, in that same region, there is the infamous Golden Triangle. Human trafficking has unfortunately been going on there for some time. Scam centers are just kind of a new danger, but it has quite a history of narcotics, first with opium and now more recently with methamphetamines. And so to what degree have you seen where the effects of some of those illicit activities have been impacting Thailand?
The amphetamine drugs are always big issue, especially from the border into the country. And now it seems like it's even harder to control. Although Thai authority try to address this issue, try to impose more like strict harsher punishment for drug, but I think with the border conflict, it make even more difficult to control this. That's one thing. Another thing is, I observe more and more news about people trafficking and like accident where traffic people got killed in the road accident because the big number of them in a pickup truck or in a hiding in the truck. And we haven't seen this, not this often before, but I think now more and more of this news. So this really showed the situation that people got in different through different means, but they cannot come in legally. And same as the drug, it got in the countries and caused impact, especially on the border area. But then how to deal with that? And I think that's still a challenge of the Thai authorities.
There's so many ways this is impacting Thailand. I mean, we've mentioned just some of them. I mean, from Thai citizens themselves being impacted by the literal violence that are coming to Thai soil, to the scam centers, to the human trafficking, to the narcotics, and you know, the spread of disease. Obviously, another the vast numbers of migration and humanitarian concerns that are there. So, you know, this is really all pointing back to where Thai politics and engagement is going to come, because you can deal with the root of the problem or try to deal with the root of the problem to have a stable neighbor where you both can try to prosper and support each other. Or, you know, you can feed the darker sides of an authoritarian state, hoping you can control this beast. But, you know, I think if you look at it honestly, there's no way you really can.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's not a perspective that the Thai authority take, right? In a way, they are quite friendly, actually, to the authoritarian regime. If you look at Cambodia, if there was no war between Cambodia, Thai authority are always friendly with Hun Sen, just because the war erupted. Otherwise, they even support each other. Thai authorities, Thai state are always friendly with Burmese government, no matter which government. But not in a way to promote democracy. And they should look at that way, that if they keep neighboring countries stable, they should be able to prosper together. But there's some elements in the Thai state or Thai elite that benefit from all this, that they can keep doing their business, their investment in Myanmar, in Laos, in Cambodia. So they will never do anything. They don't think that we can grow together. No.
There certainly are those elites that have behaved in that way. There are also those that in Thai politics and position that are quite unhappy with what's happening and would like to engage positively, but it's a complex situation and don't exactly know how. So if, and you've mentioned there's this kind of Thai or ASEAN or Southeast Asian cultural tendency to want to be more indirect. And, you know, this plays right into the junta's hand because indirect communication is exactly how they can just keep on doing what they're doing. If you were in a position, or perhaps you've been in this position where you've advised certain leaders as to an effective way of engagement, what would you say or have you said?
Oh, big question. Well, actually, I would say like what you just said earlier, that we should the marketing regime is the answer if you want stability. If because the elites are concerned about national stability, right? But not the answer is in using the marketing regime and human rights and peace. If the only when the Thai state engage and pressure the neighboring leaders towards that direction, that's the only answer. Yeah. Otherwise, you have to deal with what? How many hundred of thousands of people that got into, fled into Thailand? And look at those like what? 90,000 people in the refugee camp that got stuck here because no third country resettlement is allowed anymore. So you have to address the consequences of the armed conflict in Myanmar for now, and we have been dealing with that for 30, 40 years with the refugee camp. And it's going to repeat itself again now if you don't do anything inside to make change inside Myanmar. We will always have to bear the consequences. I mean, that's the mentality that the Thai state should look at if they care about order, stability, or prosperity. You have to do something.
And if for them to then look at engaging and doing something, do you have, it is a very complex situation. If you had a receptive actor that wanted to engage in some productive or effective way, do you have in mind how you might advise them to what could actually be effective?
At least we have some like the opposition party, a politician that are really look into all this, at least they try to engage the Thai state and some of the groups along the border to do something.
Sure, yeah. Now, another similarity, getting back down to the grassroots activist level, another similarity that we've seen among Thai and Burmese, which I know has also been an important issue for you, is the role of female leaders, of young female youth that are taking an active stand. You've researched this extensively when it comes to the Thai female activists. And we certainly have seen that in Burma as well. So I'd like to prompt you to talk a bit about what your work has shown there.
I think the... I'm trying to reflect back. I think this is not a new phenomena. Let me put it this way. Despite patriarchy culture among the Burmese or among different ethnic groups, there have always been strong women leadership, KWO, Korean women groups, or different women's groups of the ethnic groups. They are very, very, very strong. They have strong personality, they're very vocal and work for the community and always very impressed working with them. But they are always there, the women group, even before this, the last coup. But Burmese patriarchy and that culture is also very high. How much women can really take leadership if it is not the women organization, right, in the political party or political organization, that's another issue. But I think as you see more and more role of women, very, very many strong women are leaders in different organizations. That's very a good sign. But of course, there's still room to work more on this. In both Thailand and Myanmar.
And then that's looking at some of the Burmese and ethnic women leaders, certainly there's a lot of, there's been a very active background there. Looking at this Thai youth generation, you've also pointed to some of these very strong young female voices that are coming. So what can you tell us about them?
they are very strong, but they face more like challenge and more difficult time than their male colleagues. There are reports of maybe not physical sexual harassment, but online sexual harassment or attack on them every now and then. So if you were a woman, you have to, people don't trust you. People use your sexual identity to attack you, to put blame on you and everything. We still see that. And I see that some of the female activists or politicians, they have to deal with this and they struggle. I mean, they still keep doing what they are doing, but when compared to the male colleagues who would not face this kind of harassment. So that's still very sad.
Yeah, I've spoken to Sai Jai of Stop Online Harm and some of the work that she and her organization has done both in Thailand as well as Myanmar on the challenges that, you know, the identity attacks, personal attacks that come from women activists, character assassinations, doxing, everything else.
But not even among activists. Look at the former Thai Prime Minister, the two female that we had. Part of the attack that we received, they got, like Ying Lak and Pathong Than, the attack on them was just because they are women. Okay, because they are Thaksin's family, but also partly because they are women. Whatever they do, whatever they say.
But there's also some very strong and active and inspiring young Thai female activists that their courage and their sacrifices and their voice, it's incredible.
Yeah. But then how can we make the enabling environment for them? I don't think we see that much effort in that area. Yeah, they are strong. They can do it. But then how can we nurture other female activists, make sure that we will support them when something happens? I don't think I see that as much as it should be.
How would you answer your own question?
I think sometimes we leave them on their own when they got attacked. We are talking about like the activist community or even like the academics. And sometimes we take it for granted that that's something that would happen to a woman. But we need to, we as a community that support the movement, we need to come out and speak out against any attack on that. And yeah, of course, there's someone who has some work on that, but maybe not enough. Just to remind everyone that this is not what it should be.
It's a blame the victim mentality.
Yeah. We need more support.
Right. Yeah. Are there other aspects to your Myanmar engagement or study that we haven't touched on in this?
On the support of the student from Myanmar in Thailand. After the coup, not long after the coup, like a group of academics from different universities that work on Myanmar came together. We discussed on what can we do to support students, for example, CDM students or CDM scholars in Thailand whose education got disrupted. And we try to help them in many ways, but in the end, we could not really work through the official channel. Like those who may not have the full certificate to continue further study, for example. I know a number of great students or young activists who maybe they miss their final exam or thesis submission and they don't have a bachelor degree. So I cannot take them into our master degree. We did work with the Thai authorities. We tried to communicate with the Thai Ministry of Higher Education, but we still cannot solve that problem. And imagine how many of them are out there without education. Mm. I think that's something, again, a number of Thai academics or faculty of university are providing support in different ways, like research fellowship, short-term fellowship, or internship. But now, if the situation continue further, what could be the support that we can do for them? I think that's what we, I hope that there could be some way to address this issue.
And that's also where, you know, the CDM comes in, because I've also spoken to a number of students that had, it's really such a tough and courageous decision they made that they had to choose to throw away their whole educational development and study up until that point.
Yeah.
Sometimes, as you say, just on the verge of graduation, because they wanted to join a movement that showed that in no form did they support the military takeover. Mm. And now, 5 years on, they're struggling to find that accreditation. They're struggling to find that validity. It's just it's a huge sacrifice individually, but also of society. You know, that to lose the education of a whole generation, because you certainly can't have it in Myanmar. And there's things like Spring University that are helping to fill in those gaps. But with the world as it is today, it is a lot of those end up being stranded, and that's really tragic right now.
We talk about. The thing that we are struggling with is the accreditation. Mm. All those online education system out there, but they are not officially accredited.
Yeah.
We also try to explore different ways, but still cannot find the way out for this issue.
It's and as important as accreditation is, the other aspect also there is knowledge creation. How important that is, and just as you're teaching IHL to in the forms that you are, I spoke with Professor Chayan at Chiang Mai University, right? CMU, RCSD, and who has long been a supporter. And when I asked him the question, what do you see as the value of encouraging and supporting this education at a time of open conflict? His answer was very powerful and stayed with me, and that was that. They need to figure out what country they want to have. You can't do that overnight. You can't, if in a post-military Myanmar, you can't wake up the day after and say, okay, let's start creating the kind of future and country we want. There are major questions of the judiciary, of the natural resources, of the federal democracy, of all the issues of climate change, so much that we know that's going on in Myanmar. And it's not a question of one brilliant person just giving all the answers. It is an ongoing and very complicated process of bringing in the reality in the ground in concert with the literature and academic resources that are there and working towards that question of what do we know about the field and about our country that can give us designs as to how we want to move forward. And so it's not only a question of providing opportunities for those students who have lost everything. Certainly that's part of it. And that's a big part of it. And I don't mean to diminish that at all. Yeah. But added onto that are the societal advantages, as Professor Chayan said, of what knowledge sharing does to a society at this time.
Yeah, and that, I totally agree. And that bring us to the education in the, like, in the liberated area or in the ethnic control area. And that's something I also wish I would know more and learn more about that. But from what I heard, there's also issue of whether those education provided by the ethnic armed groups are also propagating for their own nationalism. And that's the future that they want to see. But that should not be the only thing that they work on, right? So how can we make sure that those different education providers out there inside Myanmar serve not only the immediate purpose of revolutionary struggle, but also have a long-term forward-looking. That's good thing. Some of my students or alumni and are working in some of those universities in different ethnic areas. I will explore more on that. What do they teach? I'm also like the director of the Southeast Asia Coalition for Academic Freedom, which work across Southeast Asia to promote and defend academic freedom, which when we look into the situation in Myanmar, of course, it's academic freedom among many other rights and freedom are in terrible situation. But part of what we are discussing and trying to set up is to have some kind of protection mechanism within the region. That links to what we talk about, the role of Thailand, the Thai University, in providing some protection to people from the conflict area or the CDM in the country. That, keeping in mind that transnational repression is very bad and on the rise also in our region, in Southeast Asia. Keeping in mind that what's happening in other countries in the region is also getting worse. In Indonesia, with the protests since October, since August, thousands of people, including hundreds of youth, are persecuted, imprisoned, and tortured. So we are seeing terrible situation in elsewhere in the region. And how can we as a region provide some safe space, safe mechanism to welcome these people? I think that's something we're still figuring out and try to work out. And also because now going to Europe, okay, there may be some opportunity. Going to the US is out of question. And but there's still many people out there who need to grow, who need to find safety. Yeah.
And have you seen progress in the movement of that work?
Yeah, there's some discussion, and we hope that some of the university may, like you talk about CSD or Asimaidon University, we are doing some kind of that work, although we may not call it a protection work, right? And there are some universities in the region who are willing to also to engage in some of these activities. And I hope that we can engage them more and more to think about the model of protection that we can work together.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an incredibly important topic, and that I think it's overlooked by some of the more obvious casualties of conflict. But, you know, these are some of the hidden ones that are just as devastating and in some ways more so, because they're not just, again, for, you know, hitting people at that time and place, but they're having these reverberations across societies for sure. Yeah. Well, I thank you for joining us for this conversation and being able to share your insights on this, over a quarter century of work you've been doing. And I would, as we've mentioned, you've been involved in so many ways with Myanmar and Thai-Myanmar relations. But I'd like to go back to that personal sense that has brought you into this work. And just as we've talked about how many Thai activists have reciprocally been able to benefit by seeing what the Burmese are doing that's informed them, I'd like to ask you personally, how have you benefited? How have you changed or been transformed in a positive way through your interactions with Myanmar and with Burmese people over these many years?
Okay, and my first response is not in the change in a positive way, but something that made me realize after 2021 coup, is I never feel that war is this close to me. Because especially in the first year when our students had to study online also because of COVID. Students in Myanmar would say, oh, Ajahn, after the class, we have to bury the computer because we study human rights,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Or we hear the story of, oh, my niece got kidnapped by the armed groups. My brother died. So that's the story we hear. Or my parents had to run away. I moved more than 4 times already. So that's the story I hear almost every day. And that made me realize, being in Thailand, we don't experience armed conflict.
Yeah.
I never feel that armed conflict or war really close to me before. So that's a personal impact that I have. Yeah. And then in terms of positive personal impression, again, I'm always curious and I keep asking people that I know on why they did the CDM very, very, very interest me, because I'm interested in political awareness and the sense of citizenship and so on. And some of the student that I saw that I didn't realize that he or she have political interest that much before. Some of my students who are like university lecturer on leave, she joined CDM, she got dismissed, and she lost all everything she has been looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then how that really make me want to also understand what make people feel that they are willing to fight for it, no matter how much it would cost them. Because we need this if we also want to make change in Thailand or everywhere.
Right,
we need that.
Right.
Okay, maybe that too much. We don't expect people to sacrifice too much, but we need that mentality that we are ready to fight for it. We are ready to fight for democracy. We are ready to fight for human rights. Yeah, that's something that, I want to know more. I want to learn from them. What triggered them to engage in this kind of activism?
We don't know who we would be or how we would respond if this happened in our own town. You know, that's the thing I've learned from it, is that when society collapses, when the unthinkable happens, we don't know who we're going to become.
Hmm.
And we might be someone who is a very confident, strong leader with a stable job and life. And when society collapses, we may that person may just not be able to do anything, and vice versa. There may be someone who's never been able to hold a job and has struggled with all kinds of problems. But then in that moment, finds themselves and engages in a way they never thought possible, or it could be a similar trajectory either way. We don't know that. I mean, that's the thing that I've learned the most from this and studying then conflicts of the past, World War II and whatnot, and seeing that when society collapses around you for whatever reason, we don't know who would become, and it would be an indication of incredible arrogance on the part of someone to assert what they would do in that situation, because we don't know. And I think what the Myanmar people have showed us, and not just showed us at this time post 21, but of course, all of the past history has led to this moment in this feeling of no more, of the last battle. What they have shown us, and especially in the United States, because as we're dealing with increasing authoritarian structures in our country, we, for the most part, we do not know how to respond to it. Mm. We do not know what to do when rule of law is not being followed, and we can't just go to, we can't just write a strongly worded editorial or go to the, go to the courts or whatnot to when we have someone kind of overriding over these normal procedures, we don't know what to do. Well, in Myanmar, they have been facing a much stricter and much more extreme authoritarian structure for many more years, and they have learned how to respond creatively and innovatively. Mm. With great risks that they've taken, but especially after 21, to a scale that I've never seen before, they have learned who they are in that moment. And I think it is something to reflect on, not to answer, because we can't, unless, hopefully we never get in that situation. But if we do, as an individual, as a society, what would we do if we found ourselves in the unthinkable? We cannot say, but we can look at Myanmar and see what they're doing.
Yeah, that's very great. And to put it, and also we cannot know, and it can also go the other way around, but that's not what happened. And they still keep fighting. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me.
We're glad to have had you with us for this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. You might know that beyond sharing stories and conversations on this platform, we also carry out humanitarian projects through our nonprofit mission, Better Burma. As we all know, the challenges these days are vast, but so too are the opportunities to provide meaningful support. Your contributions go towards supporting critical initiatives, such as providing food, medical supplies, and basic necessities to internally displaced persons in conflict zones. You can help to fund healthcare services that save lives and bring dignity to those in need. Your generosity also supports education efforts for children, helps mobile medical clinics, and provides care packages to political prisoners, just to name a few of the many programs we sponsor. You can support these impactful efforts and directly contribute to our projects, which uplift and empower those most affected by this crisis in Myanmar. Visit betterburma.org/donation to join us in this mission.
Yarananga yaunya na dadu ya dana dari ganeza de mana we gara besa yana besa yo ho ba yarananda da yarananga na yarananya da yarananga poda ba yarananga.